we have a sort of socialist country, you know. Uh-huh. We have lots of money being spent on multiple projects.
Yeah.
Are you suggesting that our local authorities dramatically cut their budgets for many of these community activities?
Yeah.
Is that what you're suggesting? Because I'm not offended by that, but I would just like to see if that's what you're actually suggesting.
Well, let me start by saying this is derived from empirical data in Canada and the United States. So I have to say that I can't talk to you about structure in a way here the way I could if you asked me that question in the United States. I can answer you this way. I think historically there has been an effort by local neighborhood residents to create an organization that allows them to be as free as possible to make their own definitions and have the power to make their own solutions. And that therefore there's been a high consciousness of where any money comes from that they get. And I think everybody in the neighborhood movement would agree that you don't want to have money from the state if you can avoid it, because it always comes with policy and program control. So they spend a lot of time trying to figure out how to get money that will allow them, right, to be free to make their own definitions and speak to their own purposes. And I think this is not helpful to you, but I think they're right about that, incidentally. But they are able, in general, to get more independent money, and this is not helpful. But most neighborhood-based citizen organizations, to the degree they need money, and usually what they want money for is to hire an organizer, right? They get it from the local churches. So there are 6 churches in the neighborhood. They might each put up $5,000 a year. That allows $30,000, and then the neighborhood organization, of which the churches would be a member, but there would be all kinds of other associations, would hire an organizer. And so the organizer is accountable to them, not to the city, right? Or they might get some money from some sympathetic foundations, right, who are committed to the development of citizen-controlled community development. And the last thing they would do would be to move toward government money. And this has nothing to do with the fact that the government has good things to do. It's just this isn't one of them, right? In fact, once they're well organized, they're probably, among other things, going to put a lot of pressure on the government to do more about some things. But it's going to be what they want, not what somebody who gives them money and says that you got to have this priority. Does that make sense?
In Scotland and Western Europe, where the state has basically already replaced religion and the church as the caring facilitator, the problem is, how do we move backwards in time? Uh-huh. You know, Scotland has a history of education, you'll know, provided by parishes. Sure. It's undoing what's been done is the question for Western Europe, I think.
Sure. And boy, am I not an advisor on that. I'm the foggiest. Why don't you convene a series of meetings of people who are knowledgeable, unlike me, and begin to say, how do we begin to establish autonomy for citizen-based organizations? So the one little thing that I can say, there is one group of organizers in the United States that's gotten a little bad publicity recently, but their general principle is good, and it's called ACORN. And they create neighborhood organizations that are based on the contributions, individual memberships of the people in the neighborhood. And they're always in really low-income neighborhoods. And yet they can raise enough money in low-income neighborhoods because they have a powerful, helpful organization that they can have one or two staff organizers. Right? I think they usually have dues of $10 a year, right? Something like that. So that's one other possibility.
Hi, my name is Peter Meadows, University of Glasgow. I'm a biologist and I also work in rural development in developing countries. Leading by stepping back, absolutely wonderful. Civil society, citizens, yeah, sure. Can you speculate, this might seem a facetious question, but it is not, it's deadly serious, the first part of it anyway. We've got a UK government at the moment when everybody's jumping off the ship. That is one aspect that I think we need to address in relation to what you've been saying. And the other aspect is completely different. The sort of money that we, the DFID, Department for International Development, British Council, and other institutions, and the United States, are now pouring into Pakistan and Afghanistan, an area that I know well. I wonder whether you'd like to talk about that a bit.
I don't know much about international development. I know only, and you could go to a website, that there is one international development group who generally uses an asset-based approach, whereas almost all the other NGOs are needs-based. And it's called the CODY Institute, C-O-A-D-Y Institute. You can go to their website, and it is the leading Canadian international development organization.
Yeah,
they've done
a lot
of research on local development from a needs versus an asset-based approach.
I'm most impressed by the Canadians. I think they've got a much better act together than the United States or Britain.
Do they? Yeah. Sure. That's why we're allied to them, AID. Yeah.
Thanks. Hello, Lalaji Bowne, with a tenuous connection to the Department of Adult and Continuing Education. continuing but tenuous. I've got one very simple factual question, then two conceptual points. The factual one is, being ignorant about the United States, I didn't gather who employed these neighborhood organizers. Are they employed by the government, or are they employed by churches, or who are they employed by?
They're employed by a neighborhood organization that generally gets the majority of its budget from the churches.
Right. Okay, thanks. Now then, the two conceptual ones. One is, I worry about a model which is a closed model, because if you look at that kind of model, it's assuming a coherent and compatible set of human beings on their own.
Yes.
Now, if you have a neighborhood like most poor neighborhoods in most cities of the world, you'll find maybe two Christians, one Muslim, one Hindu.
Yes.
You'll find somebody who supports one football club, some who supports another football club. You'll find some who thinks women shouldn't take part in anything, some who thinks they should.
Yes.
And the idea that you will get them together to get money from any propagandist institution like a church, I think is a non-starter. The beauty of getting money from the state is that the state is a secular organization. And I think that is something that has to be borne in mind. A model of a sort of community of the ideal kind that we read about in storybooks is one thing, but the reality of modern deprived neighborhoods in cities is not like that.
Yeah.
The second conceptual question is about intervention into these groups. Now, I believe to some extent, and I think it was that chap in Puerto Rico in the 1940s who first had the idea of pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps.
Yeah.
And I think there is some merit in that philosophy. But the problem is that there are certain things missing if you want to get real empowerment. If you simply want to have a little community carrying on more or less as it did before, but maybe slightly improved, that's one thing. But if you really want transformation, it seems to me that one of the elements that you absolutely have to have is access to education. And I mean, we're all sitting here because we're in education, so we would say that, wouldn't we? But without the opportunity of access to real education, and that's not just teaching people how to run a meeting, but it is education which enables people to understand their social position, to understand why they're poor and other people are rich, to understand why General Motors is laying people off and this kind of thing. If you don't allow people access to that form of education, I don't think your model will work. It won't transform their situation.
I wouldn't know. two ladies here seemed to want to jump to the fore, which is what they were jumping to the fore about here.
Thank you. My name's Angus Collins. I work in local government in Ayrshire. There's a couple of comments. I really like the model. I work with a local area coordinator who works with people with learning disabilities. That's a Western Australian model. And I think it links in very well with what you're saying about assets. The issue we have in, I think, the west of Scotland just now because of the economic situation is maybe more about physical assets as much as personal assets, because councils and other bodies are trying to push assets onto communities, and somehow it's a bit like the coercion going the other way.
Yeah.
And I just wondered if you have any comments on that whole issue. It's kind of disempowering in some ways, empowering in some ways if there are strong associations there to take that up. But I just wondered about this whole idea of physical resources and assets and communities taking control of them.
Yeah. Well, I'm just with a group of people who have a lot of local organizations that are think of assets as physical, things the government is passing on to them. And I've heard some of the things they're telling about. Let me go back to North America, and that's all I can refer to. In general, to the degree that a local group of citizens becomes more and more involved in housing and housing development and larger scale commercial and commercial development, community economic development, the experience is almost universal that it diminishes the power of the resident organization because it sucks so much time and energy up, number one. And number two, it creates a dependency necessarily on people who know about finance, insurance, banking, mortgages, right? So what has generally happened is when many, many local economic development organizations that would be focused on enhancing the local economy and housing, right, started as a subgroup of the citizens' organization. And almost universally, within a year or two, they saw this happening. It took over. And so almost everywhere, it's been spun out to make it independent of the citizens' organization because of this effect. Then, usually, there are overlapping boards. Let's say if the citizens' organization has 30 members, mostly from a range of associations, right? They, 10 of those might be on the board of the Economic Development Corporation, but then there'd be 10 other people who would be experts or affiliated with banks or that kind of thing. That's my experience. It's just simply that there are some domains where citizen knowledge gets placed in a secondary role. And that doesn't help a citizen-based organization. But I think it's good to create an organization that performs that function that is controlled finally at the top by citizens. Okay, that makes sense? All right.
Yes, I'm from Pakistan, and I want to know about some things because definitely we are using these words, SERS, community development, and other terminologies which we use to in developments.
Yeah.
But in my experience, I don't know, maybe I want to know from you because you are a learned person in this field. Because many international organizations say that we are working for the right base, and we are using right-based approach for the community development and creating associations in the village or in the in the community level to make all the developments sustainable. But it doesn't work. Why it doesn't work? It could be maybe it's a process. Is process a time-taking process? And maybe the theory is not applicable. Maybe, and maybe they are looking for the shortcuts, and for the international community who is working for the development for the developing countries, maybe their main agenda is not a development, real development, but it's just to spend money to show their figures how much they are spending in this country, in health sector, in education sector, and for the women I just want to know what's the reason behind it. Because when we look theoretically, the model is very good because you are including the people for whom we are working. You people are working, you are studying, you are doing a research, you are, you know, making a theories, putting new theories. And why it doesn't work?
Mm-hmm. Boy. Anybody here have an answer? I sure don't. Let me say, I want to say again, we've never done any research in Pakistan, or most, I'm reporting a North American base. And do I think that it can be exported to Pakistan? I would be doubly suspicious that it could, maybe. But I think development grows out of culture, genuine development, right? For instance, the United States and Canada are the main countries in the world that grew up with associations as the basic creators of the institutions and the society. So I know they're indigenous in power making, right, and citizen aggregating. Now, I don't have the impression that that's nearly so true in other places. I may be wrong, but I want to say that's the limit of what I guess I think, in my own personal view, that the trouble is that there are a bunch of people in the United States so arrogant they think they can tell you what you ought to do. I didn't vote for those people. So I'm sorry, but I'm not in any way connected to international development. But look at the Cody Institute website and their materials, and you may find something helpful there.
Tricia McConnellogue worked for an organization called Bridging the Gap. We work in the Gorbals, an area that has been regenerated four times in the last 30 years. It was just... In regards to the lady that spoke about the model and being very closed, I was actually, as soon as the professor finished there, we actually worked to that model and it works very, very well. We didn't realise we worked to it till we seen it up in the book. But we do it.
And that's how we learned it from people like you. We're just reporting.
And I was somebody that grew up in poverty and ended up, you know, getting a job. But just to kind of give you a flavour in how it works, it very much started off in the way the professor, our organisation, in the way the professor described it. It was two people listening to the rumbles in the community and thinking, right, what is it that's needed here? And there was needing a common ground because, obviously, in the west of Scotland, there's a lot of sectarianism. But without getting into the whole organisation, it's grew. And we're an ecumenical organisation, but we work with asylum seekers and refugees. We work with drug addicts, we work with alcoholics, and we work with people with special needs. And the thing about it is that these people don't all come in the door and they're all very happy and, you know, we're all talking to each other and things like that. People come from country to country and they're even at war with each other, so it's very, very difficult. Our organisation works small steps, big successes. That's my motto. And what we do is that, you know, we look for activities, we have a group of volunteers that actually, they help shape how we work, and that's with the other citizens. So it can work, it may not work in every area, but one of the things that was really refreshing that I would like to say, Professor, is that from area to area, from community to community, and it's something because of government money that we would actually... taken at the moment that kind of puts us in a box and we have to tick a box, is that for area to area, people have different needs in different communities, irrespective of where they are in Glasgow. As I say, I work in an area that's a bit more, that's not as affluent. Some bits are affluent. People are living cheek to chow with people that are in poverty and people, and it works. So I can say we're grateful that we know that we're doing the right thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I said I wasn't going to tell you anything you didn't already know, and that's absolutely right.
I thought it was very interesting to hear you talk about assets, and I think it is very true that we often do start by thinking about deficits here in Scotland. What I'm wondering is how you'd apply the idea of asset-based community development to choosing which communities you would work in and go into as an organiser.
Oh, yeah.
Would you choose the ones that had most assets, or would you choose the ones at least, or is there some other way you would think of?
You're asking me practically how has it worked? I think it usually has worked that organizers are in lower income neighborhoods. Now, see, the only thing I don't buy is those are the ones that don't have many assets.
Sure.
I'll tell you a place that has very few assets, a new housing development. It's a social desert. Nobody's connected to anybody, right? That's a really thin asset-based community, a new housing development, a peripheral suburban area. My experience is in older neighborhoods, people have had a long time to be in association, and they tend to be clearly better connected than those people. So if you think my map is an asset map, in our experience of North America, you are often liable to find that in working class, lower income communities, there are more of those assets than there are in middle or upper class communities, because they're human assets. Look, if you're in a position where the institutions are absent or discriminating against you, what's your other tool? It's your own associations. So in the black community, their associations, right, are dense and powerful for that reason, right? They've had a history of relative ignoring by major institutions, right? And the same is true in other lower income communities with a history. So I've never thought in terms of our map that it has to do with income. The trouble I think now with the word assets, from our point of view, is it is associated with money and things. And the primary asset, as you could tell, I'm focusing on is people and their relationship. So, whatever it's worth. Let me conclude with two things. Are any of you involved in policy making? Well, people are always saying to us, what policies does this suggest, right? Which is always an institutional question, right? So I want to at least give you a little walkaway tidbit, right, of a policy. Supposing you're an institution and you said, my job is to support and magnify the powers on that map. I'm a supporter, not a definer, not a controller, not a financer, but a supporter. How would I act? And an example of an institution that shifted to becoming from being a fixer to a supporter is an organization called the United Way of Atlanta, Georgia. The United Way is in Canada and the United States a big fundraising organization that raises money at the workplace from people, and they aggregate a lot of money, and then they allocate it to social service and health organizations, right? So that at the workplace, there's only one campaign a year, right? But there's a lot of money. And in Atlanta, they have been doing that for years. Now, these United Ways usually have a board of, I don't know, I would call them mucktymucks. Do you have mucktymucks here? Elites. People like. The Atlanta one is made up of the president of Coca-Cola, the president of United Parcel Service, the president of the Atlanta National Bank, the president of the Atlanta University, the president of the Child Care Association, right? All those. The mucktymucks. And they... one of them, about 7 years ago, came to the board meeting. They're the board, and they meet every month. And traditionally, what a board does, I know this doesn't happen here, but a board of a not-for-profit or an NGO in the United States made up of those kind of people, they meet once a month, and the staff comes and tells them about all the good things the group is doing, and they all say wonderful, wonderful, and they leave. I mean, it's about pretty, and they help raise money. Right? But one of the board members really became concerned about what the United Way was doing, and so at a board meeting, he said to the others, He said, you know, this is what troubles me. I'm afraid we're involved in, catch these words, perverse incentives. And this is what he meant. He said, we are funding a bunch of human service and health agencies. He says, and I've been on the board for 5 years, and I get the annual reports, and I see where we give our money. And let me tell you how it looks to me. How it looks to me is that we keep finding new needs. Let's say we discovered child abuse 10 years ago. And we say, well, we got money for child abuse, right? And maybe a new group comes in, it's formed, or two other groups say, well, we're going to get over into the child abuse field, right? And so they come to us, and we say, okay, we'll give you, I'm making up these numbers, we'll give you each $200,000, right? And they go out to Northwestern University, and they say, will you do a careful study of child abuse? And we go out, and we go around and ask everybody, do you know somebody who's abusing their children, right? I mean, so we're quantifying child abuse, right? And then we develop the numbers. And these child abuse agencies then have, they say, there are 1,200 abused children, right, discovered this year. Right. So they get their $200,000. 2 years later, they're coming back for their next allotment. And they say, we sent Northwestern University out, and they found that there were 1,800 abused children this year. So we say, well, we'll give you $300,000 then. He says, and the next year, they come back, and supposing they said to us, we were so effective that Northwestern University found that there were only 1,000 abused children. And he said to the other board members, what would our response be to that? Reduction from 1,800 to 1,000. We'd say, then you don't need $300,000. We'll give you $200,000. And he said, that's a perverse incentive. In the human service and health world, the way an institution gets more money is to show things are worse, right? And he said, that may even be an incentive for things to be worse. And he says, I'm going to resign from this board because I think we're worse than if we weren't here. And so he shook them all up, and they set up 7 task forces and met for a year thinking about this problem of perverse incentives. And they came back at the end of the year, each task force, what would you do if you rethought our mission around what are we trying to achieve? And how could we provide the incentives to achieving it and not just be dependent on agencies, but look also to citizens? And so I was invited to their annual retreat where they were asked to decide by the executive director on whether they wanted to shift to the new policies and practices that the task force had recommended ahead. And he put this up on the board. I got a copy of it from him. And this was his summary of what they had been and what this task force was recommending that they should do. And this is it. So he said, we have always focused on deficits. But the task forces are saying, if we want to really change things, we'll have to focus on assets. And so focus means, what do you do with your money? Second, we have always responded to problems. Come in and tell us about some new deficiency. But now we want to invest in opportunities. What would be a good opportunity to engage in? We used to be a charity with a charity orientation. But now we would become an investor. We want to put in a little and get something better out of it. We now just give grants, But we need more flexibility, you say, so we need to be able to give grants and loans and contracts and make investments and figure out ways to leverage our dollars. We used to say the sign of our progress was more services, but most of our services are because things that are bad are worse. So the sign of progress isn't more services, it's less services, he says. So we used to think that the way to achieve our goals was by social service and health agencies. But now our work says if we really want to change things, we would be supporting and investing in associations, businesses, agencies, and churches. We used to focus on the individual. We followed the medical model. And now we focus on investing in communities or neighborhoods. We used to seek to maintain things, at least. We've never thought of ourselves in a serious development process. We used to say that what we're doing is serving clients. We are now investing in citizens, would be. We have always thought of fixing people. Now we are investing in their potential. We used to think it was programs that were the answer. Now, and I would say citizens rather than people, we think citizens working together are our basic resource. So there's a policy shift. What would it look like in practice to become a supporter of the asset base rather than a provider of stuff? The last thing I want to share is this. This is our website, www.abcdinstitute.org. And if you go to that website, there are two subheads that you can click on that might be of interest. One is publications. And when you get to publications, you can see workbooks, which cost. They don't cost much, but you have to buy them. And the other is downloadable publications, a lot of them, and you have been given two of them here. And one of them I commend to you because it is, we think, the best tool for planning a project or having your institution become asset-based rather than institutionally a deliverable. And it's called Discovering Community Power. So that's publications. There are a lot of them. They're self-explanatory. They're almost all for neighborhood people. So they're very understandable. And the last thing is that if you go to training, the site that says training, we have an annual training for people who want to become asset-based organizers, right? And that's going to be this September. You can see it on the site. And if you're interested in coming, you're welcome. Chicago's a nice place to be in September. It's a terrible place to be in the summer, a terrible place to be in the winter. September's <it's> best. So, and we only have 60 people in that a year, or we have a lot of interaction. So if you're really interested, you'd have to let us know pretty quickly. So that's what I have to share. And there is a book, I'm sorry I don't have it, the basic book that is spread all around North America, at least, about a working book about asset-based development is on that site, and it's called Building Communities from the Inside Out. There are 110,000 of those have been sold in Canada and the United States. It's the best-selling, I think most used, guide to local community development that there is. And so if you're really serious about knowing more about this, that's the book that you probably ought to access. So thank you very much.